But I also would like to say that integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. That brings me to this. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point? That would be another question.
I'm James Wyrick, and you're listening to Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who serve and protect our nation. Welcome, listeners, to Episode 2 of Military Justice. Thanks for joining me again. And now we're going to return to the Bo Bergdahl case. I've had a number of listeners ask if they should listen to Season 2 of Serial, where Podmother Actual covered the Bo Bergdahl case. You should listen. I can't do an adequate job of informing you of all the nuanced details that Sarah Koenig did in that second season. It's really just it's a great podcast. And I think it would be even better if it was listened to in one or in a few sittings. If it was listened to as a whole, because the original schedule for season two kind of turned some people off because it seemed to focus too much on Bergdahl and not on the rest of the unit. But it finally, by the later episodes, it does a fantastic job of really looking at the case from all aspects. So I can't emphasize enough, please listen to season two of Serial. I'm not trying to help them out. They don't need any help. They probably have 300 million downloads by this time. Okay, without any further ado, let's go to Serial.
Well, wait, did people die during this search for Bergdahl as a, you know...
Yes. No, the answer is, Sarah, the answer is yes.
Okay.
So if somebody was on a mission to go find an American, you know, there's, you know, did a soldier walk down a road and an IED blew up? And if the soldier was walking down that road in an area where he would not have been had it not been for the search for Bergdahl. And in fact, his mission, their tactical mission was to, you know, conduct a patrol and try to find intelligence or try to find any indications of where this soldier might be. And in fact, was blown up by that IED or others wounded. That's a no-brainer.
There are a number of things I need to point out about General Flynn's statements there. First, and this is really just an inside the military issue, he does what many people in the military will do, but it is an absolute favorite of senior officers. When you're caught without a really good answer to something, you kind of go down an octave and you start using some jargon. So he says, you know, yes, Sarah, people died. That's a no-brainer. That's kind of FM modulating. It's kind of making up for lack of knowledge about a particular question by trying to increase the gravitas of one's voice. Secondly, now to the actual issues. So that sounds like General Flynn would be able to testify in a court and say that people died looking for Bo Bergdahl. Except, let's go back and look at his exact words. He says things like, if a soldier was on a patrol and he was blown up, that's a no-brainer. He gives a hypothetical with no name. I mean, if he's so certain that someone died, then it would seem that he would say something along the lines of, Specialist Jones was killed when his vehicle drove over an IED in Paktika province on 1 July 2008. But he doesn't do that. He just gives this hypothetical that he's sure of, yet he doesn't seem to name anybody. Number two, if he were a witness, I mean, the objection is he's not a, and I don't like this term, percipient witness. I only believe in witnesses and expert witnesses. Percipient is superfluous. But that means it's almost impossible. He's on a general officer staff at the time that this occurs. Very, very unlikely that he would have actual knowledge of somebody being blown up while on, or being killed while on a patrol. I believe he's a two-star general at the time. He's just not going to be there when it happens. So then he either reads about it or somebody tells him about, you know, that somebody died. If it's somebody telling him that somebody died looking for Bergdahl, then there's a hearsay objection. Those are out-of-court statements being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. You know, that Specialist Jones died looking for Bergdahl. Alternatively, and this is probably the more likely scenario, that General Flynn gained his knowledge from reading documents. So we have the best evidence rule come into effect. That is, if the source of knowledge comes only from a document, the testifying witness doesn't testify, you have to produce the document or explain its non-production. That still doesn't get you through the problem of the hearsay enclosed in that document. And this really illustrates the discovery burden and why it's going to take so long to get the Bo Bergdahl case to trial. For example, if General Flynn was to testify, you have those objections, hearsay, best evidence, lacks knowledge of, but also you have to prepare, fortunately for all of us, courts-martial and regular trials are adversarial. People don't just get to come into court and say, listen, Sarah, people died. That's a no-brainer. He's subject to cross-examination. And the only way that the defense team can do a proper cross-examination is to be provided with the relevant discovery. They would need the orders that sent people on that mission. They would need maps. They would need all of the other information, the after-action reports. All of those that could be used to impeach either Lieutenant General Flynn or somebody like him that would be testifying that Bo Bergdahl caused deaths. Finally, and this is illustrated in, there was a helicopter crash in August of 2011. Numerous SEALs died along with the air crew. And that's 5 years ago. It's still subject of investigation, and there's a large question as to the tactics that they used. When the helicopter was shot down, did they plan the insertion wrong because there had been Apache helicopters and an AC-130 gunship in the area for many hours before they tried to land with these SEALs? So did that alert the Taliban? I point this out because there's also there remains the causation question with Bergdahl. This SEAL case, it illustrates that things don't go well. I mean, war doesn't always end correctly. So there still is an enemy, and that enemy has free will. All of this is to try to give you a little bit of background as to why the discovery issue, and specifically classified discovery, is so vexing for the government and why it's taking so long. So to fully understand that, I'm going to need to take you and give you some background on discovery in the military justice system and explain, or at least give you a very, very general overview of the classification system used in the United States. Classification. In the United States, there's numerous rules that govern classified information. And this is governed mostly by executive order, almost exclusively by executive order. The most current one is Executive Order 13526, promulgated by President Obama. What this does is it explains in broad terms the classification system. There are countless implementing instructions that grow from that executive order, and I can't begin to get into all the detail. There's just really, it would bore you to death. It bores me even talking about it. But I'll give you a thumbnail of everything. We have three classification levels: top secret, secret, and confidential. Now, there are other things like special access programs or other caveats that could go along with those levels that could get you into myriad other classifications. But generally speaking, you have top secret, secret, and confidential. I've never seen confidential. It just always jumps to secret. So top secret and secret are the main classifications. Top secret is, quote, information the unauthorized disclosure of which reasonably could be expected to cause exceptionally grave damage to the national security that the original classification authority is able to identify and describe. Secret, quote, the information the unauthorized disclosure of which could be expected to cause serious damage to the national security and that the original classification authority is able to identify or describe, close quote. So you have the difference between exceptionally grave damage and serious damage. The next important thing to listen to in those statements, in that definition, is the original classification authority. I'm going to explain what an OCA, original classification authority, is in a moment, but that's very important for the Bo Bergdahl case. Secondly, the executive order describes the types of information, the categories of information that may be classified. One, military plans, weapon systems, or operations. Two, foreign government information. Three, intelligence activities, including covert action, intelligence sources or methods, or cryptography. Four, foreign relations or foreign activities of the United States, including confidential sources. Five, scientific, technological, or economic matters related to national security. Six, United States government programs for safeguarding nuclear materials or facilities. And finally, vulnerabilities or capabilities of systems, installations, infrastructure, projects, plans, or protection services relating to national security. And I'm sorry, there's one additional one. The development, production, or use of weapons of mass destruction. So to go back, you have to have the information must fit within one of those categories. And then secondarily, you must have an original classification authority who makes the determination of both that the information fits within a category and determines what detriment there would be to the national security, and therefore assigns a classification level. I've looked, and I can't give you a perfect number of how many original classification authorities there are in the United States government executive branch. To tell you the truth, I believe that there are some that are even classified to even get that information. That being said, I can tell you with a great deal of certainty, there are very few of these individuals. For example, in the Marine Corps, I know that there are only four individuals in the Marine Corps capable of being an original classification authority. They're 3-star generals and above. And all the executive branch agencies have one of these people, but there are very few of them. And most of their work is done by underlings who are subject matter experts in classified information. And this is why it's important, because that original classification authority, the OCA, truly owns that information. Classified information is owned by the government organization that creates it and first classifies it. So that it's that OCA that has to be, that has to sign off on the use of information in a court-martial. And that OCA could be, have nothing to do with the Army, could be from NSA, CIA, FBI, any other agency. So it's really a persuasion game, because those OCAs, they own that information. The rest of Executive Order 13526 is about access to information. You have to have a need to know. So the person has a legitimate need to know the information, plus the requisite security clearance, meaning that they have had their background looked into and that they've been adjudicated to be able to see that level of information. And they have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I've done a number of those. They're just says anything you learn, you can't tell anybody or it's illegal. Moving on from the classification authority in the United States, now we need to look at the issue of discoverability. In the military, that's governed by Rule for Court-Martial 701. That states, quote, "Trial counsel shall disclose evidence that reasonably tends to negate the guilt of the accused of an offense charged, reduce the degree of guilt of the accused of the offense charged, or third, reduce the punishment." I'm sure that as many of the listeners here have listened to Serial or Undisclosed or other true crime podcasts, you're probably familiar with Brady v. Maryland and U.S. v. Giglio. Those are Supreme Court cases that set forth what is required in discovery. For the military, it's codified. It's in RCM 701. So negate guilt, reduce the degree of guilt, or reduce the punishment. Now there's the interaction, that is the discovery standard, and that's unaltered in a prosecution where there's classified information. But there is Military Rule of Evidence 505, and that governs the use of classified information in a court-martial. It's the military analog of the Classified Information Procedures Act. It has numerous provisions in there, but for our purposes, there are three very important portions. It allows for, if there's discoverable evidence that fits under RCM 701, negate guilt, reduce punishment, it gives a mechanism for the government to provide that to the accused and his defense attorney, his or her defense attorney, and still protect the classified nature of the information. And it does that through the use of in-camera or secretive review by the military judge. And it allows generally for three types of alteration to the discoverable material. It allows for redactions, which I don't actually view as a part of SEPA or military MRE 505. Redactions just allows for that information that isn't truly discoverable can be redacted. So you would have maybe your internal tracking numbers for a document or other information that's extraneous that isn't discoverable. That's fairly normal. The latter two are the very significant parts of 505. Substitutions, that means discoverable information may be rewritten by the government as a proposed substitution that is then presented to the military judge. And finally, stipulations. That is an agreed stipulation by the parties. Let's say the defense, for example, in a Bergdahl-type case, the defense wants to submit information to the jury about the overall threat level in Paktika province when Bergdahl left his post. That would be contained in a lot of classified documents. But the parties could come to a stipulation, something along the lines of, you know, the threat level was high, there were numerous encounters with enemy fighters. And finally, it allows for protective orders. And this was fought about in the Bergdahl case. I find this excruciatingly boring. The protective orders are duplicitous with the underlying non-disclosure order you sign when you get access to classified information. But 505 and SEPA allow for that. Now I'm going to take you through a hypothetical situation and explain to you why, at last count, the government in the Bergdahl case had identified 300,000 pages of discoverable information and why that is taking them so long to get through. First of all, when a prosecutor gets this information, it either is in printed form or it comes up on a classified computer screen, and it will have a header and footer that looks a lot like an email, but a more formal email. It'll have a lot of the CCs and who it's coming from, who it's going to, where it's coming from. Much of that would not be discoverable. That's not necessary for the defense. So it's really in the body of the document, the different paragraphs within, you know, that email-looking document that would be discoverable. Caveat here, I have no information about classified documents in the Bo Bergdahl case. I'm knowledgeable about this subject area, but I have seen nothing in the Bergdahl case that it hasn't been court filings or open source reported information in the news. I just don't want to lose my ability to access secret information, or actually top secret information. That being said, this is a purely hypothetical situation. So this is a hypothetical statement that would be in one of those classified documents. Quote, CIA source Pepe Silvia observed from a distance of 10 miles using CIA super goggles, five local fighters forcibly detaining a tall, thin Caucasian outside a U.S. military outpost in Paktika province in June 2009. If you have any degree of familiarity with the Bergdahl case, this would obviously be discoverable. This could suggest that he was taken against his will, that he didn't actually go AWOL, absent without leave, or as we in the sea services, yes, Coast Guard, you're included, as we would call it, UA, unauthorized absence. So that if he was taken by enemy fighters, he's not voluntarily absenting himself from his unit. But there's a lot of information in this, again, total hypothetical, that needs to be protected. So what the prosecutors do is they work with whichever agency owns this information. So whichever agency created that report and the OCA within that agency classified it, hypothetically at the top secret level. So they would work with agency representatives of that OCA to try to work out a substitution or the redactions. So the prosecution proposes that kind of in conjunction with working with representatives of the OCA. And then they take that to the military judge. Usually, I mean, it can be done many ways, but the way I've done it is it's in a very large three-ring binder. and you have the original information. Let's say that's 2 pages of printed material. And then right behind that, you have the proposed substitution. So the judge can read both, and the judge either says yes or no, or could also say you need to include a little more information. This review and discussion is done in a SCIF, and it's a back and forth. It's just truly the basics of being a lawyer. Advocacy on advocating, getting the OCA to agree to release the material, and advocating that the military judge sign off on your proposed substitution. So in this case, I believe an adequate substitution would be 5 local fighters forcibly detained a tall, thin Caucasian outside a U.S. military outpost in Paquica province in June 2009. So that still gets the information to the Bergdahl team that it was observed that local fighters they forcibly took a Caucasian from a military outpost in the same time and place that Bergdahl would have gone missing. So let's look at what got taken out. First, the name of the reporting individual, Pepe Silvia. This is Human Intelligence, HUMINT, and that is a confidential source. So confidential source were part of the category of information that could be classified. Number 2, the first sentence about CIA source. That is an intelligence activity, another category of information that could be, that is properly classifiable. Third is observed from a distance of 10 miles using CIA super goggles. That would fall under the category of capabilities of systems. So in this scenario, the U.S. government would be justified in keeping classified the capabilities of this completely fictitious CIA super goggles. And so that would be submitted to the judge and hoping that the judge would approve it. This can take multiple rounds. I've seen it take a dozen rounds sometimes, depending on the judge and depending on the OCA. So that's what's taking so long in the Bergdahl case. There are numerous 3-letter agencies, NSA, CIA, FBI, etc., that would have discoverable information in the Bergdahl case. And the prosecutors have to work with each one of those OCAs or representatives. Okay, that's enough of me talking. Let's get back to Professor Van Landingham.
Oh, well, where we are is still in the middle of nowhere. Recently, the trial judge set a new trial date, and that new trial date is not until February of 2017, which is really rather shocking, considering that formal charges were referred, which is the formal step taken in a court martial, such as an indictment, similar but not the same to an indictment in the federal system. But formal charges were referred in October of last year. So you will have a trial almost a year and a half after the government stood up and said it was ready to go to trial by referring those charges. And so there have been, and this is unusually long. Cases normally don't take this long. And it's not a complicated case looking at the charges. To remind your listeners, the charges that Sergeant Bergdahl faces include 1 charge of desertion with intent to shirk important service, basically leaving his base. It's a specific intent crime, which means the government has to prove that he had the intent to shirk important service and avoid hazardous duty by leaving his combat outpost in the remote wilds of Afghanistan. And the second charge that he faces is called misbehavior before the enemy, but the misbehavior that he is charged with is related to the charge of desertion, but that is that he did before the enemy actually endanger the safety of his both his outpost and his entire task force by his intentional misconduct. His intentional misconduct being that he left without his base without permission. So it seems to be a bit of an overkill because there's an overlap between those two charges, but they're not multiplicious for purposes of charging or sentencing since they contain some different elements. And the different element that is component that must be proven beyond reasonable doubt by the government, that different element in the second charge, the misbehavior before the enemy, well, they both have to prove that he had the intentional misconduct, which I don't think is going to be hard to prove considering the statements that he made during both Serial and during the preliminary investigation to the investigating officer. But the government will have to prove that he actually endangered the safety of his outpost and the entire task force. And so that's going to be interesting to prove that one lone soldier actually endangered the entire task force. So the government's going to have to put on evidence that and that was because of his intentional misconduct and not because they're simply in a war zone in the first place. Because
right. They're in a dangerous area where yes. Bad things happen.
If people are harmed directly because they were sent on some search and rescue mission, which we don't have evidence of yet. There has not been any publicly released evidence. There was no evidence put on at the preliminary hearing that supports that anyone was harmed or, God forbid, killed during a search and rescue mission, which does not mean that there isn't that kind of evidence out there because there have been all sorts of media rumors, et cetera, that there were. But you're going to have to – there's something called causation. It's a concept in criminal law that – for example, if a butterfly flaps its wings here in Los Angeles, perhaps through a huge chain of events, or it'll cause a thunderstorm in Taipei, China. Well, does that mean that butterfly should be held responsible, criminally responsible? If you could suspend your imagination a little bit, suspend your belief that butterfly should be held criminally responsible for that thunderstorm that happened 2 days later because of the air currents that it changed? The concept of proximate causation would say no. There has to be some fairness because everything has a second, third, fourth, fifth collateral effect. And so how far out the court is willing to go to show that he actually endangered the safety? I mean, will the government be able to prove that there was a direct cause and effect, a but-for causation, that is, but for Sergeant Bergdahl leaving his base, an individual would not have been hurt?
It's really nice to get your professorial point of view on that, because sometimes in Serial we would have maybe more of the intel view that everything that happens has two or three orders of effect after that. But in the law, we recognize you're not going to be criminally or civilly liable after, you know, maybe the second order effect. Is that a fair way to look at it?
We can't tell. I could render an opinion, but it would be based on nothing but my own conjecture because I haven't seen the evidence that the government has. At the preliminary hearing, the government did not put on any evidence regarding endangering the safety of the unit or the overall task force. But it's not a stretch of one's imagination to think that additional search and rescue missions, which were called out, did, because it doesn't say hurt anyone. It just says endanger. And
right.
That he put them at greater risk. So by leaving your unit or leaving your outpost to go search for someone in a combat zone, is that putting that unit at greater risk? I don't think it's that hard of a conclusion to make that yes. And so therefore, whether or not you actually have to put on evidence that people were hurt, the government will want to, because that would be a matter in aggravation for sentencing. And so that would justify asking for perhaps a dishonorable discharge, any jail time, which we'll talk about in a second, because I disagree with the fact that he's actually in a court martial to begin with, and we can talk about in that moment. But I think the government will and is trying to its utmost right now to get permission from the various agencies and individuals that have classified a lot of the information regarding Afghanistan. They very much want to find evidence that individuals were hurt because of Sergeant Bergdahl's misconduct in leaving his base. And so they would have to show that they would have to meet those hurdles that he directly caused that harm and that there were no intervening events that would help break that causal chain. But if there were folks hurt on search and rescue missions that they would not have otherwise been on, you you've got that. You know, it's not that, it's not a great leap of one's imagination to think that he did actually endanger, not only endanger his unit. I mean, the kind of combat outpost that he was on was a very small one. You need every able-bodied soldier that was there. He was a capable soldier that was needed for his guard shift, and he left intentionally per his own admission before his guard shift started. And so therefore, did that make his unit more vulnerable? I would have to say yes. So, but really this case is going to come down to
Let me circle back to something you just said and your prior experience at Central Command, that you say the other agencies that would have information. For example, how many other agencies or governmental entities would be operating around, you know, that may have been involved in the search for Bergdahl?
Well, this I can comment on that without referring to any particular knowledge that I have of this specific case. But of course, the operations that we continue to run, that the U.S. military ran at the time and continue to run in Afghanistan, were not purely DOD. They're interagency. We have joint interagency task forces that were stood up specifically for the conflict in Afghanistan and conflicts, because you've got the conflict against the Taliban and then overlaid with the conflict against al-Qaeda and then with the numerous non-state armed groups that have joined the fray since, such as the Haqqani Network, which is the group that Bo Bergdahl was subsequently held, was the captive of for almost 5 years and brutally tortured by. So, of course, when I say interagency task force, that usually includes agencies, the three-letter agencies such as the CIA, for example. But you also have intelligence agencies such as DIA, such as the NSA, which, of course, works for the Department of Defense. That's the Defense Intelligence Agency. But you also have the NSA, the National Security Agency. You've got the NRO, which I think just changed its name recently, but it's the units involved, the organizations that help run our super secret spy satellites that help provide that kind of intelligence product to the warfighters through various channels. I mean, we have the Department of Justice, we have the FBI, we had the Drug Enforcement, we're Treasury, because we want to dry up the money flow to insurgents, et cetera. So all of those agencies, and I'm sure I'm missing some, have vested interests in these operations, because this was not just Army. It was not just Department of Defense. This was truly interagency operations.
And this isn't particular to the Bergdahl case. We're just saying generally that's how we fight as a nation. We go to the battlefield with all of our different agencies trying to bring their expertise.
Well, and there's also, I mean, that's a subject of a whole different podcast, should we? I mean, we still have the CIA running some assumably running some drone operations. So the CIA got into paramilitary stuff in the 70s. It did not end well for our country. So the fact that we have the CIA running paramilitary operations, because of course they don't wear uniforms, is a little problematic for an accountable democracy. And I'll leave it at that.
Right. And also, so they would have information that would be discoverable, that had to be produced in discovery for the Bergdahl case.
Well, I'll explain that, clarify that link a little bit for your listeners. For example, if someone was hurt on a particular mission to looking for Sergeant Bergdahl when he was in captivity, I mean, there would be the question of, well, how was he hurt? How do we know? Who has the information? How do we know he was hurt on that kind of mission? Perhaps that information would be held by one of these other agencies. They were following information provided by that agency. It may not seem as clear cut, but because the CIA and other agencies were involved in various search and rescue missions, and especially in providing intelligence for them, they could be uncomfortable declassifying some of this information because they may still have some informants. I mean, we're still fighting a war in Afghanistan. There are heroes out there. There are men and women in uniform fighting it right now, far away from their families this 4th of July. And I would like to take a moment to thank them for this and to thank our brothers and sisters in the three-letter agencies, even though I'm not sure they should always be involved in paramilitary operations. With the world today, the counterinsurgency fight, plus the fights against these non-state actors, these terrorist groups that are transnational, we have to bring all of our forces to bear, including the non-military forces. I would say if you're using military action, that is the use of lethal violence in pursuit of an objective, the military should be doing that because the military has an obligation to abide by the laws of war. I'm not so sure about the other agencies, but at the end of the day, it is an interagency fight. It needs to be, and I thank all Americans that are out there and our American and our partners, the non-American partners as well. There have been numerous news stories over the last several years and some recent ones regarding translators, for example, Afghan translators that risk their lives to translate for American forces, for the CIA, et cetera, because we ourselves, America has never had enough indigenous language, linguist capability to fight these wars. So we relied on translators. Now, as we're drawing down our footprint, and of course in Iraq, President Obama drew down almost the entire footprint. Now it's growing again. Footprint meaning military and American presence in the country. Translators are now being threatened. Their lives are being threatened. And so many of them would like to emigrate to the United States. And so there's some, there are some things that we owe to those folks. And I hope America does the right thing.
And there definitely could be translators with discoverable information in the Bergdahl case.
Yes, which is why. And so that brings us to the point of why is Sergeant Bergdahl's trial actually in February of 2017 when it was supposed to have been this summer.
This next segment is called Saved Rounds and Alibis. This is where I take questions from you, the listener, and I do my best to answer them. First, thank you so much for being such an engaged audience. You've really made the podcast a lot easier, and it really means a lot to have listener engagement. And I am indebted to this first listener, Mark, for correcting me. In episode one, I explained somewhat about the military justice system and talked about the services. I omitted the Coast Guard. That was a mistake on my part. The Coast Guard is part of the armed services. Absolutely. When I say, whenever I use the term service member, I definitely mean my brothers and sisters in the Coast Guard. In fact, when a young Marine judge advocate goes to his or her first school to learn about military justice, it's conducted by the Navy. It's at Naval Justice School in Newport, Rhode Island. And in every one of our classes, we have a number of Coasties or young ensigns from the Coast Guard. I've served with many members of the Coast Guard. They're great people. They should not have been omitted from the definition of either the sea service or service members. That being said, in my defense, the Coast Guard is a little bit different. Traditionally, I don't think they've ever been. They're not part of the Department of Defense, although they serve in a military-type role, and they are subject to the UCMJ. They previously were under the Department of Treasury, and post 9/11, they were reorganized, and now they fall under the Department of Homeland Security. So that's sort of an explanation, but it's not an excuse. Mark was right. I should never have left out the Coasties. And I won't do that in the future. The second and third issues or questions are sort of intermingled, but I'm going to break them out here. And I'll tell you that I've had a good amount of feedback on both of these. So first of all, the no opposition statement. In episode one, I said, if you are one of these people that's an apologist for the Department of Defense or are absolutely against any sort of military justice reform, this podcast isn't for you. A lot of people didn't like that. They said that there should be dissent, there should be opposing points of view. I've taken all of that on board, and I'm not changing. And I ask you to go through a thought experiment with me here for a moment. Let's say Wyrick goes into the garage, invents a flux capacitor, It should be rather easy to do. You just have some switches and stuff and then put it in a DeLorean. And I'm able to type in the October of 1947. Beep, boop, bop, boop, beep. Oh, we're back in 1947. Never mind the difficulties of actually trying to podcast back then because people don't have computers and I'm not sure who would listen, but we're back in 1947. The relevant discussion at the time is desegregation of the military. This is the question I'd like to ask you, the listener, that didn't that was upset when I said I didn't want people that were completely opposed to change. Would you want me to give equal time to the opponents of desegregation? I don't even know what these people would say. I can imagine, but it's some pretty repellent statements. Something along the lines of the black and the white cannot coexist and, you know, there can't be equality. I'm going to tell you, if I've invented my time machine and go back to 1947, I'm proud that I didn't have people who opposed desegregation on this podcast. I would hope that the discussion was solely about really two things. How can we most effectively and quickly desegregate the military? And number two is how can we remediate the detrimental effects segregation has had on minorities? So that's the way I feel about military justice reform also. Because the center of the center of that phalanx of sycophants that oppose any sort of fundamental reform of military justice is the generals already said you can't change it. And if you do, it'll wreck the military. That's just wrong. I've shown you previously and in later episodes, I think this is probably going to be about a 3-episode arc at one point. I'm going to go into much greater detail on the opposition to any sort of social change by the military. But that has always been the case. The military always is on the wrong side of those issues. For example, and they just have an air about them that is really, to tell you the truth, just kind of repellent. A few months ago, there's an organization called Protect Our Defenders. Fantastic colleague, man that I know, Colonel Christensen. He was the former chief prosecutor of the Air Force, and he's now a member of that organization. He had written a report about the Department of Defense submission to the Senate concerning if commanders were tougher on sexual assault cases than your local prosecutors, state prosecutors. DOD comes back. This is from the Secretary of Defense, talking about the Protect Our Defenders report authored by Colonel Christensen. This is what the Secretary of Defense writes back. The central issues raised in the report and article are based on certain misunderstandings of how the military justice system works. That quote right there deserves to have a dumb voice when I read that. Because Colonel Christensen was the chief prosecutor of the Air Force. They might disagree with him, but to say he has a fundamental misunderstanding of the military justice system, that just shows that there's no depth that opponents of reform won't stoop to. So, accordingly, I occasionally mock them. One caveat here. I am willing to entertain any, as a guest on this show, equal access to any of the admirals or generals who, as we approach the 5-year mark on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the open service of homosexuals in the U.S. military, I invite any of those admirals or generals on the show who 5 years ago took the position that open service by homosexuals would, quote, break the all-volunteer force. I would gladly have them on this show. They can explain either how, in their opinion, the all volunteer force has been broken, or why they were wrong that time, but we should listen to them this time when it comes to military justice reform. But just as a warning, if you come on here and you want to talk about the problems that have occurred since homosexuals were no longer chased out of the military, bring some data. This isn't going to be, oh, well, in my experience, this would be bad. We need numbers. Have we had reductions in retention, recruitment? Have I demand exact criteria for this destruction of the all-volunteer force, not opinion. Finally, issue number three, I've seen it's related to issue number two. I have had reviews saying not feeling the baby voice, so that certain mocking tone that I will occasionally take. I think this is true for law enforcement, physicians, EMTs, members of the military, or even those who deal with human remains, as our friend has explained so much on Deathcast. Gallows humor is necessary. If you're going to join me on delving into the world of military justice, you have to make light of things on occasion. Otherwise, it's just too depressing. So it's not a lack of taking the subject matter seriously. It's just a way of presenting things that takes the edge off. Let me give you an example. You can look this case up. It's Sergeant Schaap, S-C-H-A-P. He's a member of the United States Army, based in Germany in the early 90s. Sergeant Schaap is worried that his wife and his relationship isn't going that well. And he's kind of a little bit suspicious of his best friend, Specialist Glover. So Sergeant Schaap's wife has to go in to have an emergency gynecological procedure. At that point, she tells Schaap, "I'm pregnant. It's not your baby. It is Specialist Glover's baby." So Sergeant Schaap goes home, gets a bag, gets a knife, goes looking for Specialist Glover. He finds him right outside a chow hall, or as the Army calls it, a DFAC, or I forget what DFAC stands for, a dining facility. When Schaap finds Glover, Glover is on a payphone. For the younger listeners, that was a device that we used before cell phones to make phone calls. And we know this because there were numerous witnesses. This was in a hallway right outside of that dining facility, cafeteria. And Schaap walks up behind Glover and proceeds to saw his head off. Unfortunately, he's not able to completely saw his head off. And as Glover falls to the ground, Schaap kicks him in the head, eventually decapitating him. But it's far from over. Schaap then picks up the head, the severed head, and says, quote, "This is what you get for adultery." Then he takes the head, places it in a bag, an equipment bag. I've heard it told both as a bowling ball bag or a sports equipment bag made by the athletic company Head. So there's actually printed, emblazoned on the outside of the bag, Head, H-E-A-D. So Schaap goes back to check on his wife. He arrives in the hospital, and again, we know this because there were numerous German witnesses who testified to this, and he goes into her hospital room where she's recovering from an emergency gynecological procedure. And he says to his wife, quote, look, Diane, Glover's here. He'll sleep with you every night, only you won't sleep at night. And as he told her that, he set the severed head down on the nightstand beside her. I tell you this story not to shock you, but just to explain that if I occasionally make a joke or I talk in a more lighthearted manner, it's not because I don't take the subject matter seriously. To the contrary, I take it very seriously. But military justice can get dark, and I'm just trying to bring a little light. So thank you for all your questions and comments. I can't wait to hear from you. Thank you for joining me again on Military Justice. I've got to thank everybody who's behind making Military Justice. First, executive producer Dennis Robinson. You can find his Twitter handle in the show notes for this episode. Please follow him. He's currently engaged in an Iron Chef-like battle with Rabia Chaudhry. Next, the lovely and talented Brooke Giddings. She does all of the audio for this podcast, and I really couldn't even attempt to put this podcast together without her. Also, she has her own podcast that I can't recommend enough. It's called Actual Innocence, and it is the story of individuals who have been exonerated through the Innocence Project. In each episode, she interviews someone who has been exonerated, and they tell their story usually from their arrest, through their trial, imprisonment, and now what they're doing in life. It's really, they are very moving and important stories. And finally, there's my Uber producer, Dreadnought. He's always got my back. Wyrick out.
He was an able-bodied soldier at the moment.